to Wells. I'll take care of it, Wells would say, and almost invariably did. The flurry of changes and the vote of confidence from the influential Basses made an impression on Wall Street. Just 1 month into Eisner's tenure, Disney stocks surged. One afternoon, Eisner got a call from the ever-competitive Barry Diller. Referring to Eisner's stock options, he asked, "Is it really true you've made $3 million on paper?" "I guess so," Eisner replied, as if he himself had trouble believing it.
The only major division making money when Eisner and Wells arrived was theme parks, under the leadership of Richard Nunes, the only other member of management besides Walker and Miller to hold a board seat. Nunes and other park executives gave Eisner and Wells walking tours of both Disneyland in Anaheim and Walt Disney World in Florida during their first weeks at the company. On the visit to Disney World, Eisner brought along Ovitz and his family for moral support. Afterward, Ovitz wrote Eisner an effusive thank you note, stressing, "How much we love your family and enjoy your friendship." While Eisner had complete confidence in his ability to manage the movie and television business, he knew little about theme parks. Just as he had never seen a Disney animated film as a child, Eisner had never been taken to Disneyland. He'd been to Walt Disney World just once with his own children, though they'd been to Disneyland several times. Eisner knew that the shadow of Walt hovered over the theme parks more than any other division in the company. Disneyland had been Walt's idea. He had pursued it even over Roy O's objections, and it mirrored Walt's idea of a utopian escape from the real world that would appeal to adults as well as children. The parks were amazingly clean. Cast members, so named by Walt, were clean-cut, friendly, and helpful, every aspect of their appearance and demeanor regulated by a detailed handbook. Everything was beautiful, but not quite real. Park employees, for the most part, exhibited an almost fanatical and genuine devotion to preserving Walt's dream, an attitude cultivated in the intensive 2-week orientation that included appearing in one of the parks as a character. No tradition was more hallowed than Walt's habit of personally picking up any scrap of paper or refuse that he detected on his frequent visits to Disneyland. Walt was obsessed by cleanliness at the parks, and it was a tradition among executives to compete with one another to spot trash and pick it up. Now Eisner felt everyone was watching him. "God forbid," he worried, "that I miss a candy wrapper." The moment he saw some paper, he darted to it and bent over, then caught himself. His back was killing him. Eisner had developed severe back pain, which he attributed to stress at the prospect of being judged by park executives. Then he saw some more scraps. Considering that every step of his route had been pre-planned, with crews having replaced wilted flowers, cut the grass, repaved sidewalks, and painted facades, it looked suspiciously as if the trash had been planted. Was this a hazing of some sort? Eisner decided he just had to keep picking it up, no matter how intense the pain. As soon as the park visit was over, his back pain vanished. In planning Disneyland, Walt had assembled a hand-picked creative team of animators, directors, writers, artists, and set designers from the studio that met secretly to plan a theme park and became known as Imagineers. Originally part of Walt's WED company, which had created such tensions with the Roy side of the family, they had been merged back into the company, but still retained their own cult-like status, occupying their own warehouse in Glendale.